Welcome back. I'm Jim Brown, sitting in for Michael Enright, and this is the Sunday edition in the summer. In this hour, it's one big happy song fest with three accomplished Canadian women who are as at home with equations and atoms as they are with eighth notes and syncopated rhythms. Albert Einstein is the man who gave us E equals MC squared and all that goes with that. Less famously, he also said that if he hadn't been a physicist, he would have been a musician. "I often think in music," he said. "I get most joy in life out of music." Last September, Michael spoke to three women who completely understand where Einstein was coming from. They are all talented singers who also happen to have degrees in various branches of science. Our three singer-scientists are Isabel Bayrakderian, Diane Nalini, and Lauren Siegel. Isabel Bayrakderian is an internationally acclaimed soprano. She's been a guest on the Sunday edition many times. Before she started her career in opera, she earned a degree in engineering sciences. Diane Nalini is a jazz singer and composer who has recorded four CDs, including one called Kiss Me Like That, that's all about the relationship between music and astronomy. She was also, when Michael spoke to her, an assistant professor of physics at the University of Guelph. And Lauren Siegel is a mezzo-soprano and graduate of the Canadian Opera Company's Ensemble Studio. This year, she was Maddalena in Opera de Montreal's production of Rigoletto, and she recently earned her master's degree in physics from the University of Toronto. Diane Nalini, Lauren Siegel, and Isabel Bayrakderian came into the Sunday edition last September.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome all.
Thank you.
The relationship between science and music, how are they connected? Diane, let me start with you.
Wow, that's a huge question.
I know.
I could sort of speak from an anecdotal point of view first and just say that there does seem to be a sort of magic connection. A lot of scientists I know are not just passionate about music but play instruments. A lot of musicians I know are fascinated by science. But more than that, music is an extremely physics-heavy process in the way that it... Well, acoustics are all a matter of physics. The way that the sound is resonating in this room, the way that the acoustic paneling is designed to absorb reflections around this room, is all very much based in the fact that sound is a wave that's produced and it's created in our bodies or in our musical instruments, and it propagates out after being vibrated in some manner by our vocal cords or by the strings of a violin. And the way that we're recording our conversation today is also very much based in the very same ideas of physics, vibrations turned into some kind of sound. So at a very fundamental level, you could almost argue that music in its propagation is physics.
Is science.
But, of course, there's so much more that goes into it, the artistic and creative side of it.
Lauren, do you agree with that? Is it comes within the penumbra of science and physics and all that?
Yes, definitely. One of my personal experiences was my master's, I actually built a laser. And whenever you
Wait a minute.
Lasers,
you built a laser?
I built a laser, yes, while listening to opera, of course.
Down in the basement, you built a laser?
Yes, the basement of UFT physics building, yes.
With hammer and nails?
With lots of mirrors and lenses and metal contraptions.
Really?
Yes.
I've never met anyone who's built a laser before.
Well, it's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So what does that got to do with music? You were listening to opera while you built it?
Yes, definitely. But lasers... it's this cavity between two mirrors, which is basically what it is. You send in one small thing, and out comes this huge, powerful, directed light.
It's the light amplification by the stimulated emission of radiation.
Whoa, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed.
Well, that's something.
So whenever I'm singing, I often think about that, because our singing cavity, if it's in the right position, you can just put this small amount of energy, well, it's a large amount of energy, but you get so much out. Oh. It gets amplified so much. And so whenever I think about resonances of lasers, I think the same thing about singing. So I have to say yes, I do agree with everything you just said, Diane.
Isabel, impressive. You're nodding your head. Is that?
I should say this. The reason why I chose engineering science is I wanted to get into the engineering aspect of sciences, which is more of the practical aspect of it. Now, I don't really think about science when I sing.
All right.
When I learn my music, when I'm in the study process of it, for example, when I'm coupling certain sections, when it's triplet, that definitely helps me to categorize it in my mind and learn it very quickly, my music.
Why? How?
I don't know. Maybe because I'm so used to using math in my high school or university education, just automatically I have to categorize everything. And technically speaking, when I'm singing, I really don't, when I'm singing on stage, none of the technical thinking comes into play. It's all
You're focused on the emotion. Yeah.
However, the learning process definitely gets separated into these two things. For example, when I open a score for the first time, the very, very, very first thing I do is look at the, if it's in 3/4, I separate every bar into 3/4s. So I have to have it in front of me, my score. I have to see the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and if it changes. So that, to me, completely makes it, whether it's Debussy or whether it's Baroque, it makes it this common denominator that connects all the different music together. Now, whenever I see that, it clarifies in my brain that that. Now, the second part comes, the technical part of actual singing. That, in my university years, was a big revelation to me because it was through one of the courses, acoustic courses that I was taking, and one of the we were measuring sound waves and I volunteered my own voice. And then I found out that there's actually a correlation between the length of someone's throat.
Or vocal cords, yeah.
Not the cords.
No.
But actual larynx, pharynx, even lip. And I realized that just like there's a big difference between the flute and the piccolo sound. You know, how the longer the instrument, the deeper the sound. The shorter the instrument, the higher the pitch. So, and then I read somewhere that actually if you use your lips to extend them forward, like a fish, for example, it will help you achieve higher notes sometimes because the sound wave has a chance to make its, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The actual... the sound wave has a chance to end.
Fit in.
Yeah.
To what? What did you say?
To actually fit in within your resonating cavity. You can make it longer.
Longer or shorter. So that, to me, was the first time. I mean, obviously, my engineering was like, oh, so whatever. I was like, but you don't understand. That's an extra, tremendously extra dimension, these micromillimeters of change in my instrument, in the length of my instrument, is going to help me achieve a certain register.
And that's an understanding you get from science. Like you talked about, Diane, you talked about acoustics, the acoustical science. That's what you get from the science part of it.
So that was extremely liberating. That knowledge to me isn't something that I really use when I'm on stage. However, it's liberating to know that if I know that, and I'm very comfortable with the technical aspects of how I sing, and I'm not intimidated when I open a book on physiology and I read, yes, you have to lower that, yes, yes, of course, and I see all these graphs about where, I don't know, A-flat, the sensation of A-flat is, where the sensation of C is. I'm not intimidated by sine waves or frequencies.
Well, let me go back to, let me ask Lauren, when you're rehearsing or reading a score or whatever, does your experience in science and physics kick in at some point? As Isabel said, that she knows how to make the notes longer or deeper or higher or whatever.
One of the big ways that I think that my science background has helped was just the discipline of learning and memorizing, what we had to do a lot in my 5.5 years in the world of physics. And I think when I have to memorize a score, I'm using those same basic methods. And I think that that's really helped me. The same thing like Isabel was saying, looking at rhythms, looking at it from a math, like just fractions sort of point of view has helped so much. And other than that, just what I was saying earlier, that when I'm singing and I find something's a bit off and I feel like there's more to give, I think, oh, I just raised the palate and the cavity's bigger and then it can resonate more. So I think in those physics terms. But I think one of the most amazing things that I've been thinking about recently is how similar science and singing are, because they're so creative. You don't think science is being very creative, but once you've gotten past the whole E equals MC squared and all that sort of stuff, but trying to learn new things, you have to really think outside of anything that you've ever learned. And so you have to be very expressive, creative. Yeah. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why singers, any sort of musician and a scientist, can do really well together.
I think, if I may, I completely agree with Lauren, but will add, music, at least in my university days, was such an antidote to all the formulas that we were being fed. It was, to me, it was diametrically opposite, just so liberating to just think. I'm not talking about theory here. Performing, which is very different. Performing is just so organic and just liberating, comes from the heart. And it just, I thought one complemented the other. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I was able to give my brain a chance to just let loose. Some people do it with exercise. Yeah. You know, they go into this zone and they feel this clarity in their minds. That's what I felt when I sang, and it gave me more juice.
We did it in high school, get away from chemistry. That's the reason for rock and roll. I mean, that's... Diane, we've heard about engineering, how that helps, and the science of light and physics and so on. But connect for me, if you will, music and astronomy. I mean, I think of Gustav Holst and the planets, but what else? I mean, how do they connect?
There's William Herschel, who was also a professional musician, who dabbled in astronomy in his spare time and ended up discovering infrared and, an amazing scientist who really wanted to do science full time but had to be a musician to earn his keep. And sometimes I felt the other way around. Yeah. Sometimes I want... I actually did take time off from my physics career some years ago to do music full time.
Right.
And I loved it. I completed the composition of this third album I was working on, these settings of Shakespeare sonnets and pieces.
The Hey Nonny Nonny.
That's right, stuff. Which I had set to music, which we discussed a few visits ago. But I missed the collegiality of being in a research environment or being in a problem-solving environment. I think there's a certain, for me, there's a correlation in a way between the act of writing music. You know, for me, melodies pop into my head all the time, and then the words will come underneath the melody. It used to be that I always started out with a melody first, and then I would write words. But having worked on that Shakespeare project, it really taught me to work the other way, which was to look at a set of lyrics and then write music that was respectful of those lyrics. But beyond that, the melody usually comes like this. After that, I go through and look at the melody and figure out what kind of chords I'm going to put underneath them. Usually a bass line presents itself in my brain first, and then I have to, the chords fill out pretty organically after that. There's not much choice. Is it going to be major or minor? It has to follow the melody. It has to make sense. But there is an aspect of problem solving when you're writing musical arrangements. You're deciding which instruments you're going to use. Is there going to be a Hammond organ? Is there going to be a flute? Is it going to be guitar accompaniment or piano? There's a sort of problem-solving aspect to it, which is extremely, in my brain, sometimes quite similar to the problem-solving aspect of being a practicing research physicist, which is, you know, you're presented with problems in the lab, something's not working, you'll be darned if you know what it is, but you absolutely have to figure it out because you can't get to the next stage of your experiment without solving that problem. And it's the same with a piece of music. You can't get to the bridge if you haven't figured out how your A section is going to finish up.
All right, well, let's hear some music. Lauren, first of all, you've made a recording of Marriage of Figaro, and we're going to hear... Now, the aria is Voi che sapete? Is that it? Did I say it right?
You said it right.
That's terrific. Is there some essence of light in Mozart's music for you?
Oh, there's a lot of light in Mozart's music. This particular aria is close to my heart. I don't really sing it that much anymore, but when I started learning it was when I was still studying physics. It was one of my first arias. And this recording is from the last concert of my COC ensemble experience.
Uh-huh.
Isabel was in the concert too. It was in Ottawa for the Opera Under the Stars concert with Maestro Bradshaw conducting, which was very special
to
all of
us. The late Richard,
yes.
Yeah.
And this aria is a young boy who's singing about love. He doesn't know what it is. He doesn't know what to do. He's asking these ladies to please tell him what he's supposed to do. And there's lots of love and light and joy.
All right, we'll fire up our laser, Dean, if you would. This is Lauren Siegel, and this is from The Marriage of Figaro. This is Voi che sapete. Brava! That's Canadian mezzo-soprano Lauren Siegel with Voi che sapete from The Marriage of Figaro. You sang that in Ottawa?
Yes.
I think she's got the gene, don't you? Eh? For music. I can never get over how you can do the trills with your tongue. I can't do it.
That.
Can you all do it?
Yeah.
Can you do it?
Yeah.
You can do it. Yeah, you can. All right, together then. No. We were talking about Einstein earlier, very, very dear friend of mine. He talked about thinking in music. And I'm wondering if when you were studying science, did you think in music and the reverse when you...
I did, I have to
did
say.
Did you?
Well, I used to think, because I had this kind of... I don't know. You know, there's a kind of snobby attitude that I had when I was an undergrad that I was refused to memorize any equations because I felt I should be able to derive everything from first principles, which is all well and good, except on an exam you waste about half an hour of your time deriving all your equations over again instead of just regurgitating them like everyone else is doing. And I always thought to myself, I, you know, people say I have a good memory, but I don't think that my memory is that great. If you asked me to recite the poetry that I had to learn in high school, I would have a hard time getting through every stanza. But any song I have ever learnt,
the lyrics then
comes back.
Isn't that interesting?
It's in my brain forever. So there's something about music and words set together that anchors it. And I remember every piece of music I've ever loved or performed. I will never forget a melody. So there's something different going on in the brain when you set something to music. And I always thought, I should set all these physics formulas to music and then just sing them to myself during the exam. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Well, you know, from a biomedical engineering point of view, I can explain that. Because when we learn something, our brains create neural paths in them. And when you're combining music and words, because music is, you know, one side, the arts and creativity is one side of your hemisphere, and words and spoken are the other side of your hemisphere of your brain. So when you're learning something, you're actually creating two separate paths. So when you call up upon that memory, the brain has two ways of retrieving that information, which is why when we learn our music, I assume you too, Lauren, we have like, tomorrow wake me up and say, sing Mélisande, which is one of the most difficult scores I've ever learned, Pelléas and Mélisande by Debussy. Yeah. I would be able to sing it to you. And I think it's because we have two ways of retrieving that information.
Now that's funny, because I have a friend who stammers, he stutters. Mm-hmm. But when he sings, he doesn't.
Yes.
So there's something.
In fact, Carly Simon started to sing because she had a terrible stutter, apparently.
Really?
That was her reason for starting. And I think she had terrible stage fright as well.
Yeah.
But it was to get over that. Yeah.
So that's the neural pathways you're talking
about. I think us scientists have a lot of way of explaining things. And we can, it's not just, to us at least, it's not black magic. It's not just this magic. We actually can research and understand the cause, of it.
Except,
and we can't encapsulate magic, though.
People keep saying, or have said, I've read, that the music of Bach it's mathematical and it's precise, and if you can play Bach or if you enjoy them, then you're good at mathematics or something. There's a connection.
I hate that. I have to say, sorry. So I always feel
I do. I can't do math.
No, but I also feel like it's demeaning to Bach because there's so much more going on in his music than just symmetry and mathematics.
So more than science, you're saying.
I mean,
the emotion.
Yes, I mean, I can see the symmetries. Goethe, Lesher, Bach and all this. I can see the symmetries there on the page. But the beauty of the music, you know, you listen to St. John's Passion and you're kind of left speechless at the end of it. I was just in Leipzig for a conference this summer and I got to look at some of Bach's original scores in his handwriting. And it was such a Bach geek. Like, I was sitting there reading the score going, oh my God. And to see him having made a mistake, you know, he actually made the occasional mistake and he'd crossed little bits out and sort of scribble onto the next stave. So, you know, like the second violin part got kind of tucked in with the viola or something as he corrected his mistakes. It was just so wonderful to feel the humanity in that score. And to me, I switch off any mathematical analysis part of my brain when I'm listening to music and I just let the emotion wash over me.
Lauren, when you're performing or listening to opera down in the basement building your lasers, do you connect more with the emotion than the science of it? I mean, does it?
Yes, I definitely connect with the emotion of it all. I came to opera late in my years. I was more a Broadway musical theater gal in high school. Yes. When I was really starting loving opera was when physics was getting really, really interesting with quantum mechanics and all these great, stimulating, fascinating ideas. And opera had such a release for me, as did physics. I definitely did really love physics, still do. And opera, it just takes you to this otherworldly place where time just stands still. And sometimes I have to tell myself, breathe, remember to breathe, because it's amazing. And I have very, very vivid memories of working on that laser in the dark, looking at a tiny little red light and having opera blasting, or musical theater, I have to say. And just having that music around me just inspired me to keep going, and it just kept the energy level up and the creativity up. And I think overall, I definitely appreciate all of the scientific aspects that go into science. But overall, I just want to sit back, enjoy, and just be taken away somewhere.
I'm talking to three wonderful singers this morning. We're talking about the connection between science and music. Isabel Barak-Darian, of course, is a soprano known all over the place. She's been on our program a number of times. She has a degree in engineering science. Lauren Siegel has a degree. She's a mezzo-soprano. She has a degree in physics. And Diane Nalini is a jazz singer and also teaches physics at the University of Guelph. And all in the studio today talking about the connection between music and science. Now, Diane, you've got, this is, the CD is Kiss Me Like That.
That's yes.
The song is called Mundos Escondidos. Tell me about that.
Okay. So the album, Kiss Me Like That, is a sort of loosely, it's a collection of songs that actually was inspired by my visit to my last visit here on your program.
It's thanks to
you. Thanks to you guys and your team that I even put the album together.
Where's my royalty check?
I put a big thank you to you in the liner notes, Michael.
That's good enough.
Well, so the idea was, you know, I came in here, we were going to talk about International Year of Astronomy, and I sang, and you asked, you know,
the telescope. We're talking about Galileo and the telescope.
Yes, we were talking about Galileo's contributions to astronomy. And I remember, you asked, do you have any songs that are related to astronomy? And I scratched my head and I realized I did. And so I performed Kiss Me Like That on the show. And I got such a great response from listeners across Canada saying, where can we get that song? And I had never recorded it. And I thought, oh my God, maybe I should. And I looked at the list I had put together of possible songs that I might perform on the show and realized that there were several jazz standards and originals that I had written over the years that had a connection to astronomy, but I had never done so consciously. I didn't set about to write music that was specifically on an astronomy theme. I just think that being a scientist has somehow seeped into my songwriting. And this particular song, Mundos Escondidos, Mundos Escondidos means hidden worlds in Portuguese. And it's a song that I wrote inspired by a rainy night when I was wandering. I was living in Australia working on a nuclear microprobe, some aspects of
that. What?
I also dwell in basements building new equipment.
A nuclear microprobe?
Yes, yes. I've built Canada's first one, actually, at the University of Guelph, right? And the first high-resolution nuclear microprobe down in the basement, also in the basement.
That's cool.
I love it.
You build a laser and you build a nuclear microprobe.
Nuclear microprobe. And I also have sung
what
in
did
the
you
basement.
Build?
I've been singing.
Isabel, what have you built in the basement?
I made sure that as soon as I got my degree in biomedical engineering, I ran away from the building and became a singer. But my thesis was definitely in the microchips that get built and designed that go into the human body to help with the heart, the functioning of the heart. That was my thesis.
I should have asked this in the beginning. Did any of you or all of you go into science with the idea that, boy, I can always fall back on this if the pipes go or something? Did anybody think of that?
I will tell my version. I saw my first opera when I was 17 years old. That's when I was in my last year of high school. And as you know, with the back then we had OAC. So grade 13. So by the time you're in grade 13, you should really know what you want to do in university. And I had always been good in math and sciences. And I had always imagined my life as an engineer, really. Not so much as a scientist, but an engineer, a practical hands-on. So I went and applied to U of T, fully believing that music, as it had been part of my life, was going to be just in church or in choirs. So, and I was raised with the mentality that music is always leisure. It means always a
pastime.
And you need to get a job,
with a salary, you know, and that's how it
did
was.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Me? Well, I've been singing since I was two. So. I think I started singing before I could basically talk. My mom says they sort of came at the same time, and so I just sang my whole life. Whether it was jazz was my first love, but I sang in choirs in school, and I always dreamt that I would maybe make a living as a scientist and sort of sing on weekends or something. And so it, for me, it was a big struggle when I got an offer of a recording contract at the same time as winning the Rhodes Scholarship. It happened in the same summer, and I had to choose: go to Oxford for my PhD or stay behind and make a record. And a pianist friend of mine gave me really good advice at that time. He said, you know, you'll always be able to make a record. And as you get older, your voice will mature and
so
it will get stronger.
Oxford.
But the Oxford ring will only come around once on the merry-go-round, you know.
Lauren, same with you. Did you?
I always did music growing up, piano, and then through high school played a whole bunch of different instruments. And then sang, but mostly musical theater. And then when it came to university, the same thing like Isabel, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I think I've always just followed my passion wherever it took me. And I loved science, and I didn't even know which science to take. So I just took my two highest science marks, and suddenly I was a biophysicist. And then I only really started opera after joining the choir at York, where I was doing my undergrad. And then I started listening to opera, and then I started taking lessons. And then I just reached a point I had to choose.
But also, I mean, with opera, you really can't start it any earlier. Yeah. Really
right.
can't.
Yeah.
There is, I mean, it's such an athletic form of singing. And unless your body has matured, really has gotten over puberty and really found itself, you can't train it.
Now, Diane, the last time we were talking to you, you were building your micro nuclear thing in the basement in Australia. And we were talking about Mundos Escondidos.
That's right.
And then we got off on the other thing.
We got off on a tangent, as we do. You know, put three singers in a room and things are crazy. Yeah, so Mundos Escondidos, basically the word means hidden worlds in Portuguese. I wrote the song in Portuguese in honor of Magellan, Magalhães, for whom the two Magellanic clouds are named. And when I was living in Australia...
The explorer
who circumnavigated the globe.
He went around the world.
His team went around the globe. And the Magellanic clouds, the large and small Magellanic clouds, are the two nearest galaxies close to the Milky Way, and they are actually visible with the naked eye in the southern hemisphere. And this blew my mind, the idea that you could look up and with the naked eye see these things which look like clouds on an otherwise clear night.
Yeah.
And you're looking directly at these two galaxies, and I suppose the song is a contemplation about the possibility that there are other civilizations and other planets out there carrying life, not just in our galaxy, but perhaps in this other world. And of course, we'll never be able to hear their communications because it will take thousands of years for the signals to get to us.
But we can hear the song now. Diane Nalini, this is Mundos Escondidos.
Na estrada nessa noite tão fria, tantos milagres perdidos, tantos beijos oferecidos. Olha a lua quase cheia, veja ao seu lado escuro. Magalhães, rastros de mundos escondidos, rastros de mundos escondidos, amor, longe de ti. Luz antiga das estrelas brilha no meu coração.
From her CD, Kiss Me Like That, that is Mundos Escondidos, sung by Diane Nalini, jazz singer and astrophysicist, no, is it?
Physicist.
Physicist.
Just physicist,
okay.
Is good.
Okay. Isabel Barak-Darian, we're going to hear from you singing, not engineering. Or I wanted, that neural pathways is interesting, the heart, the split, but anyway. A composer I've never heard of.
Graun.
Karl Heinrich Graun.
Yes.
When and where and who was he?
Before Handel, even. And absolutely.
Baroque composer.
Yes. And I wanted to, I wanted us to hear this particular track, A, because it's Baroque, and also because it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning of how music, to me, it's a combination of preparation, which is very separate, mind takes over, and performance, which is heart takes over.
So there's a heart-mind split, as far as you're concerned.
The same way as the brain.
Right.
You have the left
right
hemisphere.
Oh, okay.
The same as that. And the when you hear this, you're going to hear the preparation as well as the liberation.
Now, the opera is it's Caesar and Cleopatra.
Absolutely.
Cleopatra and Cesare.
Yes, yes.
And it's the story of, obviously,
Julius Caesar, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. The famous Cleopatra. Yet another take on her.
Was he German? Was like Handel?
Yes,
Handel,
of course,
he was
there. Of course.
With a Heinrich and
yes.
The Karl. And the aria is?
Tra le porcelle assorto.
Tra la porcelle assorto.
Yes.
Here is Isabel Barak-Darian.
Thank you.
That's from Cleopatra and Cesare by Carl Heinrich Graun, and that's Tra la Procella a Sorto, sung by Isabel Barak-Darian. God, I love your voice.
Thank you. My God, I appreciate it.
All those run and up and down, and when do you breathe?
Doesn't matter, you know, you just take a breath like you do, and you just, as you lock it, and just let it go. That's it.
But that doesn't come from your engineering background. That comes from the...
good old technical work. Yes, time spent in the studio. But also it comes from actually really knowing the physiology of singing. You can't really, as a responsible singer, if you want to be able to rescue yourself in case something goes wrong on stage, in case you come down with something... you need to know how the instrument works so that you can make the right decisions to get out of a situation.
I'm told they are now teaching music and science courses at various universities.
Yes.
Including Guelph?
Yes. Well, and we've had a physics of music course going for a number of alternate years. And it's great because the music students take it as a science elective. The art students can take it as a music elective. So there's a little bit of both. And students learn about basic acoustics, you know, how Isabel mentioned it earlier, how the longer an instrument, the bigger an instrument is, the deeper its pitch is going to be. So the correlation between the size of a resonator and the pitch, also understanding the frequency content of music. So when you sing an A, let's say it's a 220 hertz A, there's going to be that fundamental frequency, and then there's going to be all the multiples of 220 hertz contained within a pitch as well.
You're nodding. You know what she's talking about.
Yes. Yeah. It's the same with the laser resonators. The same idea. Yeah, and the nice understanding all of that is really important because the relative contents of all these rich harmonics is going to partly determine the so-called timbre of an instrument. It helps to sort of... determine why a clarinet sounds like a clarinet and an oboe sounds like an oboe, even when they're playing the exact same pitch, right?
Well, so. I want to thank you all for giving us a little course in science and physics and astronomy and lasers and some beautiful music this morning. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
You are richly, richly talented folk.
Thank you. Thank
and
thank
you, but if you lose your day job, you can always go back to building lasers and nuclear... submarines or something. Thank you. Nice to have you with us this morning. Jazz singer Diane Nalini, soprano Isabel Barak-Darian, and mezzo-soprano Lauren Siegel. Apart from their musical accomplishments, which are extraordinary, all of them hold degrees in science.
Michael talked to the three divas last September. They all continue to build their careers. 2 weeks ago, Isabel Barak-Darian won rave reviews in New York when she appeared with the New York Philharmonic in Janáček's Cunning Little Vixen. Lauren Siegel will be part of the Canadian Opera Company's season next year. She'll be appearing in Offenbach's Tales of Hoffman. And Diane Nalini just keeps on singing. And here she is now with Gershwin's They All Laughed, from her album, Kiss Me Like That.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round. They all laughed when Edison recorded sound. They all laughed at Wilbur and his brother when they said that man could fly. They told Marconi wireless was a phony. It's the same old cry. They laughed at me wanting you. Said I was reaching for the moon. But oh, you came through. Now they'll have to change their tune. They all said we never could be happy. They laughed at us and how. But ho, 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 who's got the last laugh now? Thank you. To get in, they all laughed at Whitney and his cotton gin. They all laughed at Fulton and his steamboat, Hershey and his chocolate bar. Ford and his Lizzie kept the laughers busy. That's how people are. They laughed at me wanting you, said it would be hello, goodbye. And oh, you came through. Now they're eating humble pie. All said we'd never get together, darling, let's take a bow. For ho, 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 who's got the last laugh? He, 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 let's set the past laugh. Ha, 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 who's got the last laugh now?
Diane Nalini, and They All Laughed. That'll do it for the Sunday edition In the Summer this week. I'm Jim Brown, and I'll be back again next week with Cornelia Oberlander, an unsung hero of the world of landscape architecture. Unsung up until now, Cornelia Oberlander lives in Vancouver and at the age of 87 has just been awarded the international prize in her profession in recognition of a lifetime of work, and she'll be my guest next week. Also next week, Did My Mum Ever Run?, John Chipman's documentary about the 13-year-old Toronto girl who, in 1967, when no one thought women could run 42 kilometers, was the world's fastest women's marathon runner. Then she disappeared for 40 years. All that and more next week on the Sunday edition In the Summer. The program was produced this week by Mark Ulster, John Chipman, and Kate Cochran. Our technical producer is Dean Pless. Susan Mahoney is our documentary editor, and Marjorie Nickel is our executive producer. Karen Wells put the show together this week. Now, if you missed some of this program, or if you'd like to hear it again, you can go to our website, cbc.ca/thesundayedition, or you can download our podcast. And, of course, you can hear highlights of this week's program tonight on the Sunday edition, round midnight. I'm Jim Brown. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Canada Day weekend.